now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Podcast. I am Hugh Wizencroft, once again on location in Doha in one of the lavish Times apartments alongside Tom Roddy, Matt Lawton and Owen Slott. Talking about, I think, the tournament so far, we of course will look ahead to the quarterfinals as well. And we'll be discussing what this World Cup means in the grand scheme of where football is and where it's going. But gentlemen, it's good to catch up. Tell me, how's the tournament been so far for you?
Can we just nail this grandiose apartment nonsense? just so everyone knows that's ironic. It was deeply ironic.
Yeah, it was.
But thanks for that, Hugh. We have to establish that early.
So you're saying you're not enjoying the apartment side of things?
Depends who you live with, really.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Who you staying with?
Well, I have to live with Mark Aspland. And there are some people who are known to iron in the nude.
Oh, my God. Who?
Has he not done it? Your housemate?
I've only just moved in.
Naming no names. Matt, how have you found things?
Yeah, no, it's been... Look, I was here in 2019, so I knew I was here for the World Athletics. So I knew it would be logistically very easy compared to charging all over Russia 4 years ago. You know, I knew from that perspective it would be quite a pleasurable experience. But it is different. And there are obvious challenges to it all that, you know, from the most stark difference is the way we've covered it, really, is the stories that we've written, the issues that we've been focused on. That's been very different. It's been quite unique. And the tension that's created, not just with the hosts, but with FIFA. I think it's been probably the most interesting World Cup to cover. And then this is my seventh one. And I've found it, from a journalistic perspective, the most challenging, but the most interesting.
More details? Have you been tracked by FIFA? Has there been a black SUV following in the streets whenever you get in a taxi?
Not quite, but it's been, as I say, I think tension is the best word. And I think to, going back to that Infantino press conference, which was, misguided to say the least, his whole sort of angle of attack, trying to turn it on the Western media. You know, how dare they bring up these issues? How dare they talk about human rights? Basically accusing the West of being hypocrites. I thought it was misguided, but it kind of set the tone. You know, we had already been writing a lot about this stuff. We'd already been writing about the rights of migrant workers and the abuses and as I say, back in 2019, I sat with Al-Thawadi, the head of the Supreme Committee, and got into those issues. And back in 2019, they made certain assurances that they, 3 years later, they haven't delivered on. So it's been interesting from that perspective, but important.
There's an element of embarrassment I actually feel in the fact I've been here nearly a month now, and the inevitable question when you get home is what was it like? What's Qatar like? And actually, kind of covering England, I've been in a bit more of a cycle of going down to their training base every day, which is a little bit, takes you back to being a student sitting exams in a sports hall, because that's what it essentially is. Mm-hmm. You've been there here, so you know what it's like. But I've been here nearly a month, and actually I don't think I've spoken to one Qatari so far. And that's a strange experience. And that's partly my fault. I mean, it'd be quite interesting actually for Owen to talk about the opening game and what Owen did that night, because that was a really interesting piece. But when I first arrived, you were getting Ubers around, even though, as Matt said, the metro system here is brilliant. But I was getting some Ubers around, and you would ask the migrant workers who were driving, a lot of them are from Sri Lanka, and you would ask them what they thought of the World Cup. And there was a element of unease around the way in which they sort of responded. It felt like people were treading on eggshells around that subject. You know, I've been a believer that it is the World Cup. It should take place all around the world, but it is quite uncomfortable at times, a lot of times, the way that you are treated by the migrant workers, because even around the local supermarkets and around the stadiums, just around the whole city, where it does... I read a piece recently which compared it to feeling like what the Deep South would have been like, and actually that's... It made me feel uncomfortable. It was quite unsettling, because that is how it does feel at times.
That's a really good analogy to compare it to the Deep South like that. The migrant workers have been so friendly, and you just can't help but warm to them. They love to chat to you and that, but at the same time, you know that they're earning probably £1 an hour or £1.50 an hour, or in some cases I've read less. And also at the same time, we're in the nation where the civilian population have the highest per capita earning a year of anywhere in the world. And that differentiation is something that you can wander around for a week and forget about it, because that this is the thing, isn't it? The football's been so incredibly amazing that you can just forget it. But at the same time, it's in your face every day.
I saw that comparison too. I know there are a lot of people uncomfortable with comparing. I know certain people thought the Deep South reference was to a certain period of time that was maybe post-slavery, the early stages of, the economic situation in the Deep South, where people who had been part of the transatlantic slave trade were then moving into paying, I use in inverted commas, their workers, rather than the period before that, where I don't think we're saying that this is exactly comparable with people being taken from Africa on boats to be slaves. Mm-hmm. But there is, you know, and lots of the, the activist groups would say that this is a modern day slavery.
Yeah.
You know, very much so.
And just on the, you've seen the videos of the teams going back to the hotels after wins and the confetti thrown in the air and Jack Grealish dancing around, and in they enjoy it, and they're you understand why they've enjoyed it. But at the same, I actually felt quite uncomfortable seeing that, because I don't think it didn't feel authentic, and a lot of this World Cup doesn't feel authentic. Yeah. You go to the stadiums, and there was, especially the last game, England Senegal, and you had this brilliant, there wasn't lots of Senegal fans there, but the ones who were there, they were dancing and singing and had the drums out and this brilliant glow of colour, and they were drowned out by the DJ. And it's not just FIFA's fault.
I can't stand it.
UEFA do it as well. They did it during Euro 2020.
Yeah.
But they're so desperate to create this brilliant atmosphere that appears like an excellent World Cup at home, that it actually makes it inauthentic.
Yeah. What's wrong with some Arabic music or something that places us in the part of the world that we're at, rather than the idea is that to make this a really groovy modern World Cup, it's got to feel Western. That's the music is one of the many things that makes me think that.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a big, I don't know if it's Guns N' Roses, there's a big rock song that comes on at one point and the lights start flashing and you get this sort of lightning imagery around the stadium. But at three Argentina games, where they're making so much noise from an hour and a half before kickoff, you really want to scream at someone from FIFA. You don't need the music before this game. The sound is incredible. The fans are bouncing. The drums are going. They didn't really get that message. And just on the Senegal fans, I mean, it was probably 2,000, 3,000. Their ability to keep the noise inside the stadium going on their own has been remarkable. One of the best things about the tournament.
It was brilliant. But what I think has been a consistent theme has been the control that they're trying to exert the whole time. The fact of the matter, I was talking to a gay fan who's been here. And the fact of the matter is, after having their their flag, their rainbow flag, yeah, taken off them. They then passed through security, and there was a hut handing out flags in the colours of the two teams for free. So the whole idea with that is they're trying to control the visual image, you know, what the image that's broadcast to the world, what people see. That's been the situation the whole way through. We've never had a World Cup where, for instance, and I think it was a piece in the New York Times, where, and I noticed them as you probably did, Slotty, at that first game, that opening game, was the fact that there were the Qatari fans that were sat there, pretty emotionless, really, very conservative, didn't get excited at sort of key moments in the game. But sat alongside them was this group of 3,000-4,000 fans in Qatari colours, but it turns out they're all Lebanese, and they're a bunch of kids from, you know, Lebanese kids who have been paid to be here to create this noise. And they actually had these four guys stood on the wall at the front of the stadium who were almost directing them like an orchestra. And that's really false and really disturbing. The same has been true of a group of Saudi fans. Apparently there were 5,000 Saudi fans here, all of whom have been paid to be here to make that noise, to create that atmosphere. And as I say, that's something I've never seen before in a World Cup.
Yeah. No, that saddens me, because the Saudi fans have been my favourites. I mean that genuinely. I went to, been to two of their games, the Argentina game and the Mexico game, and they were just absolutely unbelievable.
Oh, you get what you pay for.
Well, yeah. They earn their money, that's for sure.
Yeah. It has been one of the more intriguing things. I did the Wales games in the group stage, and I noticed it was strange. At full time, suddenly you saw a section that was just Wales flags everywhere and people going ballistic, regardless of the result as well, which made it even more strange, because it was like, if you were Wales fans, I'm not sure you'd be as delighted at the final whistle as the red wall at the other end of the stadium. But there you go. Like, it has been one of the more peculiar things.
One of the funniest stories was one that Matt wrote about the stadium attendances, where you go into the stadium and every game there are quite a lot of empty seats. But after a while, the published attendances started going above the official capacity of the stadium. It was just like, the ultimate acknowledgement that you can't believe what you see.
Well, they literally, it was hilarious. We raised this with people at FIFA at the media centre and said, how come your attendances are higher than the stated capacities of the stadiums? And in some cases, you're talking 7,000 or 8,000 above. And about 2 hours later, all the attendances changed on the website.
Yeah. The capacities?
Yeah, all the capacities changed. And it was like, I think I might have triggered that.
How
does this compare to the other six that you've been to in terms of the way that the host nation wants it to appear as a success?
I was never aware of any kind of sort of coercive control, if you like, in any of the ones prior to that. Just wasn't, it wasn't there. So in that respect, no, it's been completely different. It's been like nothing I've ever seen. I didn't cover the Olympic Games in Beijing. So you probably did, Slotty.
Both of them.
So maybe you've got a...
So it sounds like a name drop.
Maybe you've got
I couldn't say I've been to 17 World Cups like that.
but maybe you've seen this before. I haven't. It's been very, very strange.
Well, I was at the Winter Olympics at the start of the year, and so I can relate that to what you were allowed to see and what you weren't allowed to see, and the show that they put on trying to persuade you what to believe in that. But even that this World Cup is on a completely different level, absolutely different level, the way they tried to manage the thought processes, the image that people take away with them.
Well, what do we make of the, I guess, Qatari claims that there's European discrimination, racism when it comes to the difference between the World Cup in Russia and how they feel it's been covered in Qatar? You know, I mean, it's not just the Qataris, obviously. It's the likes of Infantino pointing the finger as well. Any basis to that, in your opinion?
Well, I can tell you from a gay rights perspective that, talking to people in that community, that in Russia, while there were similar concerns going into that World Cup, it was much more relaxed. Gay fans who went to Russia openly met people from the gay community in Russia. It was far less intimidating. So for a start, that look, I think people are absolutely right to say we have our own issues. We have our own problems at home, of course. But I think there's a willingness more to evolve. And the fact of the matter is, I don't think, you know, the World Cup was awarded to Qatar in 2010, and there has been no effort made to change, evolve, address any of these issues. As I say, when I sat with Hassan Al-Thawadi back in 2019, I was given assurances, as were the other journalists there, that there would be a real effort to make people feel welcome. The fact of the matter is, people turned up, they had their flags confiscated, they had their hats confiscated.
Yeah.
They were made to feel that they couldn't be themselves, that they couldn't express themselves. Whatever FIFA assurances were given, and even in that first week that I arrived, I met the head of FIFA fan engagement at the fan park, and she said, no, everyone will be able to come here and express themselves. Everyone will be able to be themselves. They will be able to show affection towards their partners openly. It's not been the case.
It's been an interesting experience in the culture. I still don't understand what they think the power of that flag is. Like, I don't know what they think the public reaction would be if people had brought the rainbow flags into the stadium. That's one thing I find weird, because I think it was almost unnecessary. It just creates a story that wasn't needed. I mean, I don't know what they thought the Qatari public's reaction would be, you know, change their partners to a different gender had they witnessed these flags. And there weren't going to be that many of them in stadia. And it's interesting because I think some people's reaction is to feel like they're a political statement, possibly. But there's plenty of Palestinian flags and there's absolutely no issue with that. So it's not that they really care that you're making a political statement per se, regardless of what you think about that situation. But I think it is, you know, this LGBT thing has become maybe in the Qatari leadership's eyes something much bigger than I think we would see it as. I mean, that's obvious, but I find it very strange.
I think what it shows is it's an absolute red line for them. There is a complete intolerance. It means they don't want to even have, you know,
a conception of
have any visibility of
it.
And it's actually, even though it's very different, the same goes for alcohol. They basically said 2 days before, you know what? No, we're not having alcohol being sold at a stadium. In particular, we were talking about it because we were near Education City, and we were saying that in particular, because of what the whole Education City complex is supposed to represent, absolutely no chance that they were going to let beer be sold at the Education City Stadium. And I just think they are, in certain parts of their culture, they simply will not tolerate it. And I think that's what that has demonstrated.
One of the things that I found really interesting, this whole experience has been such a cultural kind of head-spinning education. And we're talking about these things, LGBT, etc. So you're not allowed a rainbow flag, but every day at this World Cup, there are images of liberated women from around the world here in the stadium, on the streets, not being covered up, looking like modern women. For me, one of the most powerful images of the whole of the World Cup was the female refereeing team. You know, showing that gender should be equal, showing that women can be powerful, that they can, and that is totally against the national culture here, isn't it? But did they not think about that, or was that just something that they couldn't control? You know, where do they decide we're not going to have alcohol, but we can have liberated women? And it's fascinating.
Yeah, their response, I think, would be to that many of the women here are liberated, have voices of power. I think I'm just saying that is, I think, would be their response, even though the culture is to dress differently and behave differently in public. I think they would feel like the two things actually do compute. And a modern woman, I imagine you mean sort of Western ideas of a modern woman rather than Middle Eastern ideas of a modern woman. But I think their argument would be, well, you know, we've got successful women here who are contributing in a similar way to women anywhere else.
I they can say that, but I could just can't stomach even that. I went to a Qatari house, as Thomas mentioned at the start, I went to a Qatari house to watch the opening game, and the women weren't allowed to watch it with the men. They were elsewhere. The men showed me this magnificent family tree on the wall, which which, you know, was amazing, sort of going back generations. They showed me where they were. This is my brother, this is my brother, this is my other brother. And I said, where are your sisters on the family tree? And they said, oh, we haven't got any women on this family tree. There's another family tree somewhere else where we put the women on. I mean, what do you make of that? Yeah.
I wanted to ask you guys what you think the World Cup, this World Cup means, Qatar 2022, as a moment in time and for football as a whole going forward. What does this mean? Is it a change? Is it a moment that we will look back on in, you know, 50 years time and say that was the moment that football changed in one direction or another, Tom?
Yes. Yeah, it feels like, I was going to say dipping your toe in, but it feels like we jumped straight into the deep end rather than dipping your toe in. The strange thing is that we've got the possibility of the Saudi Arabia World Cup, the joint Saudi Arabia World Cup in 2030. But what it also means, and of course it's easy, it's actually quite easy to forget about it out here, but the logistics of having a Winter World Cup are, we've spoken about loads on the podcast in the lead up to coming out here, but it's been ridiculous for leagues, and managers have spoken about it. And of course, we come final on the 18th of December. You go straight back, and you've got Carabao Cup games on the 19th, 24 hours after. Premier League returns on Boxing Day. The logistics of having a Winter World Cup are totally uncomfortable and kind of improper, really, for all the leagues. Like I said before, I do think it's right that the World Cup should go around the world. It's just the locations they're held, and like the beer ban, it didn't bother me out here. The timing was poor, but it didn't bother me because there are elements of things that we should respect, and the dry nature of this country is fine with me. So that actually, that element of that didn't bother me at all. Others obviously do.
What do you guys think? What does Qatar 2022 mean? What will it mean when we look back, do you think?
Look, I think it's been good in the sense that there's been a slight power shift, that the African teams are proving more successful at this World Cup, that the Arab teams have done well. But I think it also will put more pressure on FIFA to make sure that their choice of where a World Cup is held is appropriate. I think it will hopefully provide a guarantee that there is a change in the criteria for where a World Cup should be hosted. Because the fact of the matter is, certain groups of people have not been made to feel welcome here. And that has to be part of the criteria going forward, because it isn't right. It isn't right that people have had to adapt their behaviours, have been made to feel afraid. That can't be something that's allowed to be repeated.
There's an argument, though, that they would say, well, you know, we're uncomfortable having to go to a football stadium where pints of alcohol are being thrown around, you know, and we've had to do that in however many World Cups gone by. So we adjust to a different culture if we want to visit a World Cup, and you would have to do the same in a different part of the world.
I think the interesting thing about this is that we're having to confront and think about how the traditional West, which has been sort of the host of most big events, how do we interact with the Muslim world? You know, we can't just say we have to have it all our own way, which is kind of what you're suggesting. We're not right, and it's not that we're right and they're wrong, but this has in many ways been a PR disaster, this World Cup, because we've been talking about problems so much, but then again, we can't just say, oh, we're not going to take a World Cup or Olympics to a Muslim country again, because we have to interface. The world has to develop like that. And the other thing is that this part of the world is the wealthiest part of the world at the moment, and it costs a hell of a lot to put on one of these things. And there's not a lot of Western hands going up to stage Olympics, for instance.
Yeah. But what you're touching on there, Hugh, is actually one of the positives, because actually the alcohol ban has, a lot of people are saying it, has been one of the good things about this World Cup. And I think that will be food for thought going forward. Should FIFA look at actually banning alcohol at stadiums in future tournaments? Because it's made for a much more positive experience for a lot of fans. You know, I was talking to Matt Dickinson about this earlier in the tournament, and he was bemoaning the fact that alcohol sales at the stadium have been implemented, because when he goes to QPR as a season ticket holder, he quite likes to have a couple of beers with his mates, but he doesn't necessarily represent the fans that that becomes a problem for, that we saw at the European Championships last year. At the first England game, I spent a couple of hours outside the metro station just speaking to England fans arriving. And a lot of the women I spoke to, you know, women England fans, just thought it was so much better, because they, you know, they weren't having to endure the kind of boorish behaviour that sometimes exists at football matches. So I do think that is something that should be revisited.
I'm agreeing with everything you're saying, by the way, but I'm immediately thinking, is it just the English football fans that are terrible with beer?
No, and the fact of the matter is, the one serious incident of trouble that has occurred at this tournament involved Argentina and Mexico fans. So no, it's not exclusive, but you have to say that in the sort of history of hooligan behaviour in football, England is right up there.
Are the fans who caused that behaviour here as well?
I don't think a lot of them are, no, because I think that is also a contributing factor to the fact that we've got through four games so far without a single arrest of an English or Welsh fan. I was talking to the most senior British police officer who's out here, and he was saying he thinks you've probably got to go back to Spain in 82, perhaps even Mexico in 70, when that's happened before. Now, the fact, you know, in fairness to England fans, there are only three arrests in Russia. Fans were pretty well behaved there. Again, I think because of the... And this is not to say because people are affluent, more affluent, they behave better. But I just think it's a slightly different group that have come. We will see more this weekend. I think we could see up to 15,000 England fans for the France game. So perhaps that means there's more potential. But I just think the fact that these stadiums are dry is certainly, that's the view of the police, is that dry stadiums is a major factor in better behaviour.
So have we seen basically a power shift here in Qatar 2022? More tournaments in the regions like this, maybe at a different time, you know, open to basically anything going forward? Because I think obviously the decision for the World Cup in 2030 is going to be huge. Who's going to be making that decision? How? And you mentioned what the remit might be, if you like, to be able to host a competition like this. But essentially, we've broken every mold here. Like every single mold that we thought was a hard line in terms of hosting the World Cup's been broken, and it hasn't. You know, it hasn't been perfect, but it hasn't been a shambles, really. Like, the games have been okay.
I'm not opposed to a Winter World Cup being repeated. I mean, I think it clearly it's been a nightmare for clubs and the traditional clubs and leagues. But surely, with a bit more thinking and planning and a bit more time either side, it could be made to work better.
Maybe that is the case. But, I mean, they would say that the calendar's already packed. How much more can you shift? I mean, the games were, we had what, about 10, 12 games squeezed into 6 weeks towards the end of the domestic calendar, and the season began at the beginning of August. They would say there's not much.
I would just say, can you not extend the domestic season, start it even earlier and extend it another week or two later, and just to alleviate the pinch points a bit? Mm. That sort of thing could be managed.
I do think, like Arsene Wenger's ridiculous claim that the teams that were more focused on political statements are the ones that slipped up in the first round. I do actually think that a contributing factor to some of the surprises in the group stages is the fact that teams hadn't been given an opportunity to prepare.
Yeah,
correct. You know, and now that's been good for the spectator.
Yeah.
It's been good for the neutral, seeing these upsets. But I do think that has been problematic. You know, normally England would have had two or three warm-up games. They were normally pretty awful matches, but they get a chance to reform as a team and prepare properly. That just hasn't happened for this World Cup. They're straight in. The first game is like, it was like that sort of first friendly that an international team gets to play.
Yeah. And the group stage has been like the warm-up phase before a normal World Cup, hasn't it? And if you've started, if day one's been problematic or you've had a tricky group or whatever, then, well, as we've seen, Germany, you just sort of tumble out, don't you? Never quite got their act together. Yeah.
Just going back to the shifts, it's probably already happened, but we haven't seen it yet, is that this is going to be one of the most unique tournaments in the close proximity of all the stadiums. I mean, you experienced Russia 4 years ago and the travelling all around the country. Here it takes an hour to get from the furthest stadium to the next furthest stadium. And then you look with the tournaments coming up, and the shift has already happened in that we're looking at the joint bids now. That's what they want to do going forward. Mm. The joint bids, that's what they are suggesting and preferring. So I think a shift has already happened.
For me, I think this World Cup was the World Cup that people would basically say or do anything for money. I mean, by the way, I don't discount myself from that. So if someone's got a big offer out there, let me know. But David Beckham.
Can I come with you?
Exactly. Arsene Wenger, Gianni Infantino. I mean, saying just patently ridiculous things. You know, this is the World Cup of falseness. I mean, we've all experienced it being here. I mean, if you look at any of the promotional material, Qatar is a glittering, shiny metropolis of a place, which is not the reality, obviously.
My favourite moment was actually at the opening ceremony, and anyone that's been to the Al Bayt Stadium knows that it is just a desert. It's just a pancake. And there's our cleaner.
Shall I get answer the door?
Go ahead.
Is this when you get delivered sort of donuts and fresh coffee?
Yes. It's the Ocado delivery. No, my favourite moment was during the opening ceremony when they had this, what certainly on TV was supposed to be like a drone shot of the stadium. And there was this wonderful landscape beyond the stadium, this sort of Arabic landscape of mountains and moonlight and stars. And of course, the reality is that you step outside the Al Bayt Stadium and it's just a wasteland. Yeah. There are no mountains in view.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was, for me, that was the ultimate attempt to try and represent something that isn't really here. And extraordinary to even do that.
Yeah. That's a little bit like Beijing Olympics. Sorry, Beijing Olympics 2208. With the opening ceremony, the pitch had this fantastic firework display sort of going all the way down the main mall into the city from the stadium. And it just didn't happen. They'd recorded it on TV like sort of 3 weeks beforehand and then just tapped it on. Mm. I mean, it was just fake.
My understanding of it is it's all been about perception, because again, at the Al Bayt Stadium, you go for a wander before the games, and they've built this kind of fan zone festival area, and you walk around, and I mean, they're football fans, they're there to watch the game, and there's someone performing on stage who I've not heard of. You see,
you're too young for Chesney Hawke, aren't you?
Chesney Republica Hawke. Were at the game the other day. Yeah, I mean,
you see people doing tricks, skills with footballs, and they're all being recorded for social media. There was a group of Senegal fans who had been taken to this seat and told to celebrate and dance and do all this. And I thought it was great, and I was walking over, and then I realised that actually this was for a recording. This wasn't authentic. Then it was cut, do it again, because it was all for the perception of the person at home all around the globe, the spectator at home, to see it and think, wow, that looks brilliant. But actually the experience on the ground, it's the games have been good, but you can get that anywhere, really. Anywhere the game should be good. The quality of the football, the competition, that's the basis of the sport.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Let's talk football before we go. The small matter of the quarterfinals at the World Cup. Don't know which games you'll be covering, but tell me what you're looking forward to. Of course, Argentina against the Netherlands, Brazil against Croatia on Friday. Saturday sees Portugal take on Morocco and England, of course, facing France. Should we just focus on England? Matt Lawson, what do you think about the Raheem Sterling situation?
Have we got long enough on this recording for that answer?
I think it's been an unnecessary mess. And it started with false information being circulated on Sunday night. There has been an incident quite clearly at Raheem Sterling's home back in Surrey, which is distressing. If his family have come back from holiday, not from holiday, from here, they were out here obviously to visit with other families. And if they've returned home and there has been some form of burglary, which the police are now investigating, that is a distressing situation, that is upsetting. However, on Sunday night, we were told by his people that there were armed invaders, that the family were at home, and this was why he'd had to fly home to be with his family. Totally understandable. And we all reported on this horrifying ordeal that his family had been subjected to. Clearly, I think it was given as a reason to justify why he had left Qatar. And the problem that I don't think they anticipated was the fact that the next morning, Surrey police came out and said, no. There's no reports of anyone being armed in this incident, and actually the family were not at home. And that has created a situation that's raised a lot of questions, and unnecessary questions. And for me, the big problem with it has been that the FA has completely failed to take control of the situation. He's their player. He's a member of a 26-man squad at a World Cup, and the lack of information, the lack of guidance that's come from the FA. I literally saw a member of the FA communication staff virtually running away from a journalist on Sunday night at the stadium because they didn't want to be subjected to questions about what had happened to Raheem Sterling. As I say, I have sympathy for Raheem Sterling. I have no issue with him going home to support his family at this time. What I do have an issue is false information being given out. Now, there may be an explanation for that. It may have been a lack of communication, but no one has even, or cross wires, but no one has even come out and said that's what's happened. And there's just been this vacuum in which lots of theories are being put out there. And it's just been a distraction, and it's a distraction for Gareth and the team. And my issue with it is that he's now going to be asked about it in his pre-match press conferences when he should just be focused on how to stop Mbappe and how to win a match, how to win a football match. And I just think, as I say, I have covered a lot of World Cups. I have covered a lot of England matches. I've rarely seen the FA look more incompetent at managing a situation during a major tournament.
Might be easier to answer the questions if Raheem Sterling is on his way back, which might be as we speak. So we'll see exactly what Gareth Southgate has to say a little bit later or tomorrow in his pre-match comments. Ahead of the game itself, how are we feeling as England fans? We all want England to do well. There's no secret France fan here, is there?
No, but I think we have to say that we're impartial and journalists rather than England fans. I certainly feel that way. I mean, I'd be celebrating if they win, that's for sure. But
I wish we were like this, the journalists from the other countries that wore their shirts in the media areas. And,
and then applaud their team, their manager when he comes in for the press conference.
Why can't we do that? Why can't we applaud Southgate into the...
we had at the final of the European Championships last year, we had an Italian fan who was sat among us, and when Italy equalised, he actually jumped out of his seat and started to gesture to the England fans that were about the nearest ones to the press box, that were about 30 metres away. And I can't repeat on air what he was saying, but it was F you, basically. And he was gesturing to the fans. So a couple of us told him just to sit down. You know, he had a laptop and he was working there as a journalist. And then he responded to that at the end when Italy won on penalties by actually pulling on his Italy shirt and doing the same to the journalists sat around him. He was eventually ejected by the stewards. So, yeah, I think we at the times we try to avoid such behaviour, don't we?
I think maybe if England were to win the World Cup, I think we would drop this sort of the English froid dure, and I would applaud Southgate into a press conference if they won it. I think that would be a nice gesture. You're even frowning at that, Matt.
I remember being uncomfortable when a colleague tried to start a round of applause after Eriksen's last game in Germany, after they'd been eliminated, and tried to give him a round of applause
for being eliminated.
For his 5-6 years in charge, and I thought that was inappropriate. I think I would certainly congratulate Gareth if he won the World Cup.
We won't tell anyone if you're caught clapping.
It's a tricky one. Of course, you want them to win. You're pleased for them, and actually, I think I feel more supportive of this group than I have of previous groups. They're likeable, this lot.
I concur with that. I think that's a good point. I think this is an England team that I feel proud to be properly associated with.
Yeah, they are a likeable bunch. There are no massive egos. You know, I think Harry Kane sums up this group really in how down to earth he is, in how likable he is, in how professional he is, and Southgate is the master of diplomacy and being liked by. Obviously, he's had a few boos and jeers in the last few months, but I think again he's won people back. You do want them to do well.
I think the Raheem Sterling story actually also feeds into this and England, because he was the best player for England at Euro 2020. And actually, the Senegal game, he wasn't even going to start. And that tells you something about the depth that this squad has. My one concern, you have to find a balance, and maybe they have found it after the last two tournaments, but you have to find a balance between confidence and... and arrogance. And I'm not saying they're leaning into the arrogant side, but there have been a few comments saying we're a great side, we deserve more respect for our performances. France will be by far the biggest test they'll have, by far, and there are still huge question marks over the defence. The attack is the most impressive part, as I say, without Sterling. Bukayo Saka was one of the stars of 2021, Euro 2020, and we almost take for granted what he's doing at this tournament.
Yeah. What do we do then against the French? Are we confident? Are we arrogant? Are we the arrogant ones now? Should we be arrogant and go into that game and approach it as we've approached the previous games, on the front foot, 4-3-3. I keep talking about the formation, but I do find it the most intriguing thing. Someone messaged me yesterday and said, I find this Kyle Walker press conference a bit strange in that he's essentially saying that he's starting. And I was like, well, he is. He is starting. I mean, you wouldn't expect Harry Kane to do a press conference and not make out that he was starting. Kyle Walker is integral to this team. He's starting. So him talking about how he's going to deal with Mbappe is obvious. The question is, is he going to be doing it on his own, or is Kieran Trippier or Trent Alexander-Arnold going to be helping him out? And I think, are we thinking about that a little bit too much? Because a lot of people say, oh, their midfield's not that great, Rabiot and Tchouaméni, and you're sort of like, well, they've been very good in this tournament. They're a lot better at keeping the ball than we are. They're a lot more calm in possession. I agree with you totally. It's going to be a huge, huge test. But maybe we're guilty of thinking too much about Mbappe's talents in terms of how we win this game.
Personally, I would not want to see him change the formation because the front six unit is working so well. Henderson's reintroduction, that midfield three, I don't think you can tamper with that. But what I do think will happen is that when France are in possession, it will fall upon Saka and perhaps even Henderson to support Walker. And I think that's what will happen. You know, they are both, they've both got great engines. You know, they're both great athletes. And I don't see why. And Henderson has defensive instincts. He's a terrific footballer, but he is not afraid to get stuck in, try and win the ball. You know, I think the first few seconds against Senegal, it was Henderson who charged in and won possession. And I just think that's the way they have to work, that there has to be a doubling up on Mbappe, but it's done in a way that doesn't mean that you've got to change the formation, because I think it's working too well. And it's what makes England dangerous at this tournament. And I don't think Gareth and Steve Holland can mess with that too much.
I liked what Walker said yesterday about them having to worry about us. There's this natural inclination to start looking at Mbappe and Griezmann and Giroud and thinking what I said before about this being the biggest test of England's credentials at this World Cup. And all of that is absolutely true, but there's that fine line between fear and confidence. And I liked the fact Walker said they've got to worry about Harry Kane's ability in front of goal. They've got to worry about Jude Bellingham, who has been the absolute superstar of this tournament, and the moment that he's really, really emerging out here. And I think he'll be the player we remember this tournament for in an England shirt. One of the things I thought Walker said really interesting about the formation, that it doesn't really matter, he said. It doesn't really matter to what we do. I think it does to an element. I think the midfield three that Matt referred to, and we're speaking Thursday morning, the day after Declan Rice missed England training due to illness. So we will find out today whether he's trained or whether he's going to train tomorrow. And I think that is going to be huge for England because of the balance that they have. And his role in this team has been so important, but also selfless, because he sees himself as having the ability to do what Bellingham's done, to have the ability to do what Henderson's done. But actually, he's been that insurance, that screen in front of the defence that allows Bellingham to get forward and show that quality he has going for. The goal that we saw Henderson score, that Bellingham set up, I don't think that happens if you don't have Rice in the team. So he will be, if he isn't fit and 100%, I think that will be a really significant blow, one of the most significant blows England could
have. Yeah, I mean, if Declan Rice doesn't make it, it's going to be five at the back. It's going to be Henderson and Bellingham in the midfield. It will certainly change the system, I think.
Right. Just one of the things that I find interesting about this whole Mbappe debate, and I know it's been slightly packaged this way because Kyle Walker happened to be doing the media for England yesterday, is there's this feeling that obviously England have a plan, and Kyle Walker's England's fastest defender, and he's done well against Mbappe in their Champions League games. But I just think surely the French will have some kind of tactical answer to this themselves, and maybe they'll want to see if they can get Mbappe running against someone else instead of Kyle Walker and playing him not coming in from the left as he has done at this World Cup, and maybe running a bit more centrally at someone like Harry Maguire. I mean, that's what I would be doing.
I've not watched enough of PSG to be sure on this, but the interesting thing was that Walker yesterday said, I've never played against Mbappe. When we played against PSG, I had Neymar on my side. And so whether that is part of it or not, I'm not sure, but get him out on the right hand side. It may be more beneficial to them.
Mbappe makes the choice. I think it's up to him.
That's correct.
He's not getting moved unless he says he's getting moved. Even true. Didier Deschamps can't do anything about that, having won it as a player and a coach already, because I think we've seen him really emerge in terms of that Messi Ronaldo type influence on his teams. Now Kylian Mbappe is able to conduct how things might go. I think he'll fancy a little run out against Kyle Walker, and if it doesn't go well, he'll probably tell Ousmane Dembele, let me have a go on the right for a bit, and then I'll go at Luke Shaw. But yeah, it might boil down to him. Do we feel confident that England will get a result?
Not overly. I think they've got a chance, but I do think they are the underdogs. I think France, you know, look, we're talking about him. He's the best player in the world right now, Mbappe. He looked absolutely deadly the other night. And that is going to be the main threat and the main challenge. And I do think that, put it this way, if England beat France, then I think they have got a really good chance in this tournament. But I think it will be the hardest game they have at this tournament.
Yeah, I agree.
But bizarrely, watching France, I think you're absolutely right in that he has turned into their Messi, their Ronaldo. And I don't think that's actually a good thing for the France team, because watching them, I don't think it's conducive to a team effort where they essentially give him the ball and hope.
But it also doesn't suit, I guess, the pattern that we've seen from France and French football for a long, long time. No. In that, you know, if you have that one figure who says it's all about me, usually the rest of the squad doesn't like that person or doesn't get along with that person. That usually affects their results. I mean, the last person that was Zinedine Zidane, I think, in terms of French football, who just about got away with it. But I know that a lot of his teammates were unhappy when he returned for France and said, if I come back, I need to be captain. You know, and I think it was Patrick Vieira at the time. You know, it's like, really? Yeah. you know, but there you go. I don't think they can maybe have another generation.
But this is also a weakened France team, and it is why all the focus is on Mbappe, because it's a tournament where you look back at 2018, they haven't got Benzema, they haven't got Kante, they haven't got Pogba. That's like England missing Sterling, Bellingham and Rice.
I'm working on a piece along these sort of lines for our Saturday paper. So people who listen to this will be excited about this now, won't they?
Check it out now.
But been talking to some of the French journalists about this very thing. My question being, what would happen if Benzema was here? I mean, he is the Ballon d'Or, so he is, you know, in inverted commas, the best player in the world at the moment. And the consensus is, well, Benzema would play instead of Giroud.
Yeah.
But we think we're a better team without him because of the sort of power play politics around it. What's happened is that Giroud plays second fiddle to Mbappe, and Mbappe leading the orchestra has just been allowed to grow into this sort of superstar, and they feel that they're better to have that, which is contrary to what you were saying, which is they're not so much a team anymore. Either they're like a one-man vehicle. But how can we get our bus driver to sort of, you know, tear another hole in the defence.
Mm. It's going to be an intriguing game. You know, I love a prediction, Tom Roddy.
I am going to go England win 1-0.
2-1 to France in normal time.
Interesting. Matt Lawton, 5-0 England, do it.
No, I tend to agree with Slotty. As I say, I'll be delighted if England get through, because this is a super group of players. And there's loads of talent, particularly going forward. But I think 2-1 France.
It's going to be a big one. Gentlemen, thank you. Probably the biggest game of the World Cup so far. We will, of course, react to Friday's games next time we're together. And we will look ahead to that game. So I'll save my prediction for the next podcast. But thank you, gentlemen. Thank you all for listening from here in Doha. It's goodbye. But make sure you download the Times app or pick up a paper. Loads of great writing being done right now from this tournament. And, of course, you can check us out. thetimes.co.uk/thegame, as I always tell you. And we will see you tomorrow.
Thank you.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.